That will be Senators Dunbar, Klayman, and Willikowski. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Carrie Cooper-Ryder and Amanda Kraft for their help in letting us execute this meeting by their work. Please silence your cell phones. So today, the committee is taking up one item, and that's SB 48, Carbon Offset Program on State Land. It is in from Senate rules by request of the governor. This last week on Monday, we heard from state foresters describing our forests. We then heard from geology and carbon industry expert on Wednesday. So we've had some educational background, and today we'll actually be walking through the bill. So first I will invite John Boyle, the commissioner designee from the Department of Natural Resources, to come to the table. He'll be joined by Christy Collis, director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and Rena Miller, special assistant. Hello, commissioner.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. This is John Boyle, commissioner designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you this afternoon. You know, I want to start off by thanking the committee for the series of hearings that we've had over the past few days, which, you know, I think have highlighted to the committee the same kind of information that we in the administration have received, which is there's a tremendous amount of opportunity and promise associated with these carbon offset projects here in Alaska. And in particular, what I'm most excited about is really the opportunity that we have to really rethink and change the paradigm for how we manage our forests, you know, particularly in the interior, and the opportunities that carbon offset projects give us to not only manage our forests in a way that provide for healthier trees, that absorb more carbon, that are more resilient to wildfire and things of that nature, but really provide opportunities to grow our forest products industry. And I think, you know, the messages that we've heard and that we'll continue to hear is that carbon offset projects are not an either-or choice. You know, we're not choosing to value not cutting down trees over, you know, potential other uses for our lands and forests. Really, it gives us a suite of tools that we can use to not only process and harvest more timber, but also to, you know, realize additional revenue streams to the state that help diversify our economy, will help, you know, grow our budget and provide other economic opportunities throughout the state. So I'm really excited about the opportunities that are present here. I think that the questions that the committee has around managing risk and how we balance, you know, other interests like mineral interest and things like that in conjunction with carbon offsets are good. I think those discussions have been productive, and I think, you know, we all, you know, are coming to the realization that there really are a lot of opportunities in this space, and that, you know, as a state, I think we can look forward to really seeing this take off and take us in new and exciting directions as we look forward into the future. So with that, if no one has any specific questions for me, I'd be happy to turn it over to Rena Miller, who's my special assistant, and Christy Collis, who's our director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, to walk us through the sectional analysis.
I don't see any questions for you, Commissioner. While the two women are coming forward, your staff, I will also highlight that Allison Arians, Deputy Director of Division of Forestry, is online. David LePain, Director and State Geologist of GGS. Christopher Orman, Natural Resources Attorney, Department of Law. And Melanie Worden, Chief of Minerals Resource Section, Division of Geology, Geophysical Surveys. So, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Giesel, Chair Giesel, and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to present SB 48 to you today. You beat me to referencing who's online. Thank you so very much for doing that. We're glad to have a team working with us here in the committee room. So the bill broadly is going to enable the state to evaluate new opportunities to generate revenue from Alaska's resources in a new way through biologic or nature-based carbon management. It does this by allowing DNR to undertake carbon offset projects on state land, including on the three state forests, and it also allows for private parties to lease state land for carbon management purposes. One of the exciting things about it, as the commissioner designee stated, is that, you know, DNR feels that this is something that can be very compatible with other uses, which are also very important to Alaska. So you have heard this week from a tremendous field of experts that talked a lot about what carbon management is and what the markets look like. So without being redundant, I will just very briefly reiterate that carbon management involves reducing greenhouse gases either by preventing those emissions at the source, or such as like a power plant, or by pulling CO2 from the atmosphere that's already there. And as this slide shows, you've got the source maybe of carbon CO2 emissions on the left, a power plant. That ties into the CCUS geological sequestration bill that may be before this committee at a future time and is one form of carbon management. But it also ties into the offsets bill that we have before you, which are the nature-based carbon removal projects. Just wanted to make sure that we're clear there's two different bills for two different kinds of carbon management, and this one focuses on the nature-based offsets. Broadly speaking, a project is a way for companies who contribute to greenhouse gases to mitigate that footprint. They purchase credits that are generated by projects that someone that has control over land and resources does. Those projects store carbon and prevent its release into the atmosphere. You're essentially taking actions through your project, be that a management technique or something more physical like planting something, that would increase the ability of those natural resources, trees, kelp, grasslands, and other areas to pull CO2 from the atmosphere and store it. The longer that that living matter stays intact, the more CO2 it pulls from the atmosphere. The projects are developed in conjunction with a specific registry with really specific methodologies and standards or protocols, I think you've heard them called this week, that the project needs to follow in order for the registry to basically approve that project as real and as a project that it's willing to issue credits to for CO2 tons of removed or reduced emissions. The credits that are generated by the project are then sold on a market. In this case, the state's looking generally at that voluntary market that you heard a lot about this week. The credits can be applied to the buyer's emissions ledger to help them meet whatever internal climate change or emissions reductions goals that they may have.
Ms. Miller, before you go on from that slide, first I wanted to remind you to identify yourself for the record, but I have a question. So you're here talking about working with the registry, project data, et cetera. So additionality is a key piece of this. So I know the state foresters online, maybe you want to ask that person, or pardon me, the deputy director of the Division of Forestries online. But my question is, remind me, how many board feet are we harvesting now from our forests that we would not be harvesting?
Senator Giesel, that is a very specific question that is very appropriate to the deputy director, Allison Ahrens. I will say when we talk about additionality, our understanding is that that is going to be a very project-specific, very site-specific kind of calculation. It's hard at this point to kind of talk too much about what specific additionality any given concept might have.
Well, let me just ask Allison Ahrens. Ms. Ahrens, can you estimate how many board feet we're harvesting now in general across the state?
Certainly, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Allison Ahrens, Deputy Director of the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection within the Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair, the question of exactly how many board feet, I can certainly, that varies from year to year, and I could get you let me just look at my handy brochure. So you were asking about how much how much we're harvesting now and how much that would change. I'm sorry, I'm not quite certain what you were.
The fundamental question is, how many board feet are we harvesting now?
We're harvesting now, let's see, so last year, fiscal year 22, we harvested 9,599,000 board feet. In fiscal year 21, it was 42,345. So it certainly varies from year to year over time.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm not sure. I can give you a 10-year rundown of the board feet that we've harvested over time, if that's of interest.
Not necessary. You gave me an idea. It does vary. Co-Chair Bishop, you had a question.
Yeah, I liked your question. If she's going to provide us with further data, could you have her break it down statewide by region? That was a good question.
That would be great. Ms. Arians, could you do that and just send it to my office? I'll distribute it to committee members.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I will absolutely do that. I'll send you the 10-year totals and the divided up between Coastal Southeast, Coastal South Central, and Northern Region.
That would be awesome. Thank you very much. All right, any other questions at this point for the Forestry Division? All right, Ms. Miller, I'll let you continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, this is Rena Miller. So we pulled this slide from a recent report by Shell forecasting significant growth in the carbon offsets market. And we think it affirms largely what you heard this week from people who actually work in carbon management, that the market is in fact real and it's growing and there is opportunity there. We couple that with the knowledge of other projects that have seen success in Alaska, such as those with the Alaska Native Corporations. DNR, of course, expects to engage in that voluntary market for some of the reasons that you frankly heard articulated by your panelists this week. And we see real potential for the state to sponsor carbon offset projects that generate credits that we can sell to other companies who want to balance out those ledgers.
Ms. Miller, could you pause again? Because this slide takes me to the money piece that I wanted to ask about. So I've been reading that the voluntary market value has cavitated. It's gone down dramatically from something like $25 per credit to $2 per credit. And I'm hearing it contrasted with the cap and trade market. Has the state dug into any of that kind of financial value?
Senator Giesel, Madam Chair, I don't know to the degree to which the state has dug into those specific values that you're referencing, but I'm happy to follow up on that with you. My understanding is that voluntary market does fluctuate in value, that there is a range, and it's largely based on what buyers are willing to pay, how they see that credit valued. I think that those fluctuations could probably have to do to some degree with the particular credits that are on the market at any given time, and the kinds of qualities associated with them that you heard other people talk about this week, co-benefits, charisma, things like that. The bottom line is that we are understanding there is the expectation of significant increase in that voluntary market. And of course, for the compliance market, there may be more stability, but as a state owner of public land, there seems to be less opportunity for the state to engage in that compliance market due to some of the requirements to meet the California state laws in particular that that you're subject to.
Thank you.
So we talked about the fact that, you know, we think the market is there and that Alaska has a real opportunity to look deeper at this. Alaska has the resources. There's tremendous potential. We have so much forested land, both in state forests and outside of that. So much tidal and submerged land. We hear about potential of kelp potentially in the future with carbon offset projects. the general potential has been affirmed to some degree by a third party. DNR contracted with Anu, who you heard from earlier this week, as a consultant to take a look at the kinds of projects that the state could get up and running quickly as essentially pilots. They started with the state forests as a very known large resource with a lot of data already associated with them that Anu could extrapolate from. The report's not, their evaluation is not intended to be a conclusive look at the potential of all state land, but simply to pull out, sure, there is potential. We can readily identify these three kind of conceptual projects, and that told the state that this is worth exploring more. This is this has that potential. There's also, of course, the potential for the benefits to the state that go beyond revenue. It's diversification of revenue sources, potentially, including diversification of revenue from new resources. There's also the potential for economic development. Perhaps these could be tied to forest management, jobs, and local communities. And there's also the potential to shift some of the marginal or unfavorable economics associated with timber harvest and maybe even mineral exploration on state forested land and other land that's not currently accessible by those industries at on an economic basis. There's a likelihood with the offset programs that you will need to put a road in to be able to access the sites that you need to in order to do all of the tree measuring and such similar work. Finally, you know, while DNR has a opportunity, there's also a sense that there may be a responsibility to evaluate some of these new opportunities under that duty that the department has to really develop state's resources by making them available for that maximum use consistent with the public interest. Is there a question before
you go on? Yes, Senator Kaufman has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Miller. Excuse me. Voice is not top notch today. I'm trying to understand. I thought I just heard you say that to like prove or manage a parcel, we would have to put a road in.
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's a possibility. I know we've also talked about maybe in more remote areas, helicopters could be required. But in those instances where it is something where we can use a road in order to access the land that needs to be, the trees that need to be accounted for and measured and remeasured, that may be possible.
Yes, ma'am. Follow up, please.
Follow up, Senator Kaufman.
I'm just picturing the kind of the ecological conflict that someone would have if we have to build a road in order to verify the ecological benefit of it. That's going to be a real emotional issue for some.
Senator Kaufman, I think it could be an emotional issue for some.
Yes, ma'am. All right, thank you.
Continue. Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Absolutely. We talked about our great resource, and this map shows general land status. It's a map I know you are all well familiar with. What we're working on and don't have quite yet available is the map that shows state land where a project could theoretically occur. The intent, of course, of the bill is to make the broadest possible suite of carbon offset projects possible. What we don't just yet have data on from a project from an offset project standpoint is all those potential state lands. To get there, we need to consider legislatively designated areas that the legislature has specifically in statute set aside as named properties with very specific management instructions and mandates. In some cases, those may be very compatible with a carbon offset project. In other cases, it may not be compatible. And it's a matter of going through those one by one and really looking at those specific terms. But we do have our GIS and mapping staff working on such a map, and we will eagerly share it with this committee when we do. So we've talked about the opportunity, but I think there were some really great potential questions raised this week through your various panels and presentations. You know, there were questions posed like, why would people pay us for having forests that we already have? How does this impact other land uses? How do we get to additionality? And what's the potential for leakage and what are reversals and how do we mitigate for those? And I think we really appreciate people raising these as things that need to be considered. We don't think that they're insurmountable problems or unanswerable questions. In fact, we understand they are quite manageable within a carbon offset project framework. Enabling DNR under this bill would invest the resources to build the capacity and access the expertise to make sure that the department is in fact able to address these issues, these questions in proposed projects once those actually come to us in a manner that protects the state's best interests. And again, like we discussed with additionality, projects are really going to be considered that way on a case-by-case basis, and there's no one answer for any of these questions, right, that is uniform against every potential project that might occur on state land. But, of course, we want to explore that. And so to that end...
Ms. Miller, could you pause again once more before starting this slide? Senator Kaufman, question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Through the chair. I was just thinking, we've been immersing ourselves in these terms, and there's probably some folks that are watching that or that will watch, you know, the recording. If we could just go through just a very brief, I know time is precious, but very brief definition of terms of what does additionality mean, leakage. This may be confusing folks.
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, I think that we can certainly do that in a general way. So we do actually define some of these within the bill. Additionality is really that reduction in greenhouse gas or CO2 emissions, or the increase in carbon storage that you achieve in a project that's addition to the baseline, what you're doing anyway, right? You already have trees growing in the forest. You already have something there. What are you going to do as a project that creates more, right? And so that's what we're talking about generally with additionality. Leakage is essentially the potential for a project to, leakage would be the potential for a project's reductions to kind of leak out, right? Maybe there's a forest fire. Maybe there's another situation in which you don't really achieve those benefits. And so with leakage, it's something that these contracts mitigate for and it's just something one has to consider when you're coming to those terms. Reversals are generally, with reversals, you're essentially looking at stopping the project. You're saying there's a different use, there's a reason we can't do this. This project is not going to generate these at this time. And in that case, again, those contractual terms with a registry and with buyers and potentially the project developer include kind of buffers against that.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. And for the public who's listening, these definitions do start on page 6 of the bill itself, which, again, folks have access to that online. And they continue on to line 7. So I'll let you proceed.
Thank you. So the department is interested in enabling these carbon offset projects on the state's vast land holdings. We want to do that by making carbon management a possible use of state land under law, by allowing the Department of Natural Resources to lease land to third parties for carbon management purposes. By tasking DNR with standing up the carbon offsets program in the bill that would enable DNR to do state-sponsored projects on state land. And then we would also, you know, look at these opportunities by inventorying and assessing what the state's resources are, how suitable they may be, what the prospectivity is. We expect largely for project developers, some of these kinds of companies like ANU or Finite Carbon that talked to you this week and their counterparts to come to us also and say, hey, we see a potential project on this state land. So it's not all incumbent upon the state to identify where those may be. So the bill generally adds this new option to the state's land management toolkit. It also provides a lot of flexibility as the state engages in a commercial market. There's some flexibility that's required to be on an equal footing, frankly, with the counterparties that you're dealing with. It allows DNR to, I'm sorry, I lost track there. Sometimes. It does protect the public interest in the state lands and multiple use land management. That's largely through the best interest findings that are required, either to lease state land to a third party for a carbon management purpose or for the state to undertake a project of its own and register it with the registry. It also maintains those existing land uses that are dear to Alaskans. Again, things like public access, subsistence, recreational access. So drilling down on those a little bit, the bill would enable private parties to lease state land for carbon management projects. Under these terms, a lease would be capped at 55 years. That gives the potential time required by a registry to conduct your project, but doesn't go too far beyond that. Lease compensation specifically needs to be designed to maximize the return to the state. DNR has to, again, go through that best interest finding, which does involve public process, to determine that issuing this lease is in the best interest of the state. And the leasee preference is not conveyed. So the leaseholder does not get any priority rights or preferential rights should that land be put up for sale at the end of that lease or another long-term lease offered. The other part of the bill, of course, we talked about how it stands up within the Department of Natural Resources, the Carbon Offset Program. The Carbon Offset Program would enable the state itself to undertake carbon offset projects on state land. The bill sets out the evaluation criteria that the department would need to use to consider whether or not to approve a particular proposal. Part of that criteria includes considering what the state and local economic benefits might be. Proposed projects also go through a best interest finding for a state-sponsored project. Again, that also involves the public process. This part of the bill would make eligible state land available for carbon offset projects among the other uses that state land is also eligible for. State-sponsored projects would not be allowed on legislatively withdrawn land, such as state parks, refuges, recreation areas, without legislative approval. The bill does grant legislative approval for carbon projects on the state forests, which are legislatively withdrawn land, but just those state forests. For state-sponsored projects, there's a requirement that state land remain open to the public for those traditional uses. And there is a fund created so that revenue from a carbon offset program to the state pays for the administrative costs of the program and potentially for additional carbon offset projects. Other questions before I go on?
Okay. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair for Ms. Miller, at some point, I'm wondering if we could see a standard, what a contract for this would look like, and I don't know if you know, like a typical contract has been put forth of what we could expect if we were, you know, going into contractual agreement around what's being proposed. I think it would be good to look at. A few things come to mind. If one way to evaluate an investment, if I buy it today and sell it tomorrow, how much money do I have left? And I would kind of like to see the impact of that in this arrangement. And I think having a typical contract in hand and being able to think about it in those terms, basically, what's the broker's fee on this thing if I decide to get in and I decide to get out because conditions change, and what are the provisions within the bill? So that these are kind of some high-level questions I have, and I wasn't sure what the best point would be to ask those. And that would be, again, as we learned earlier, around a reversal. So if we decide to execute a reversal. So anyway, thank you.
As Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's a great question, and I will look into it. generally understanding, though, that each project development company that you may contract with to do this has potentially widely different standards of contracts. There's some that apparently might just bill you by the hour for working to get your project lined up with the registry and all of that. There's other ones that are almost turnkey, some that maybe offer to upfront all the costs. They all have different kind of methodologies that way. And so we'll look into that a little bit more and try to see what we can put together that would lay out some of those really common provisions, I think, at least, that would be things that the state would definitely be taking a really hard look at. Okay. Good. Okay. So moving on, we briefly talked about how the bill does grant that legislative approval to do carbon offset projects in the state forests. We're talking about the Haynes State Forest, Southeast State Forest, and Tanana Valley. It basically adds carbon offset projects to the existing non-timber uses that are possible within these lands. And then it goes in and requires that the management plans identify appropriate forest land for projects. And our take is that that's a broad identification. And then it requires eventually then a project proposal to be consistent with a forest management plan.
Coach Bishop, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Miller, bullet point number two, can you explain that a little deeper for me? And here's what I'm thinking, and it'll help you answer the question. So I read this as it says, for its face value, adds carbon offset projects to existing non-timber uses. And I'm thinking the tundra on the north slope of Alaska. How much carbon does that take out of the atmosphere annually? And then would that be a potential non-existing timber resource that could be sold as a credit?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, so the bullet here is specific to the three state forests, right? So in the management plans and management guidance and statute for the three state forests, it would add carbon offset projects to the potential non-timber uses of those forests, right? So that's part one. And then part two, related to tundra, would be outside of the forest conversation, right? Because that's not where the state forests would be. And I don't know that we've particularly looked within the department or talked to folks who have interest in tundra in a carbon offset project at this point. Can I turn to Director Collis? She may have some better information there.
For the record, this is Christy Collis, Director for the Division of Mine, Land, and Water. Don't have anything specific except for the fact that we have seen that tundra does actually absorb a lot of carbon, but we've been told that the actual carbon market for tundra doesn't really exist quite yet, so it's always an option in the future if we have this program in place that maybe that's something that could come along in the future. That's just not something that's been identified right now to have a market. Kind of similar to kelp. Kelp is something that we have already, people are selling for consumption, and we believe will also be something that could be a future market, but we just don't have it from a news report, something saying that there's a market for it right now.
And if maybe I could jump in. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee, for the record. Really, the intent behind the bill is to kind of provide that broad flexibility that we feel that we need as the department to go out and engage and evaluate those other opportunities, because I think, Senator Bishop, you bring up a really good point. We have tundra, we have intact ecosystems, we have extensive, wetland networks. We have, maybe you have minerals that you can't mine for one reason or the next that you have the right to mine. And there's I've heard proponents say that there may be opportunities there for, if understanding how much energy and how much emissions are associated with that development, if you were to forego that, is there a market, for people to compensate you for doing things like that. So again, a lot of this is very nascent. It is, Senator Giesel brought up earlier, you know, there are fluctuations in the market. You know, we'll see where things settle, but I think we do want that broad flexibility to really take a look at all the options that are on the table and make that comparison with other potential uses to see if it makes sense for the state to engage, you know, in that space or not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. All right. So we'll actually be going through a sectional of the bill now.
Madam Chair, we're prepared to do that if you'd like.
I would. That would be great.
Very good. I believe you have a sectional analysis with your documents. So we start with Section 1. And Section 1 of the bill exempts the carbon offset program contracts from the state procurement code. We do this to enable the state, again, to interact in a field that is commercially driven, to position the state on more equal footing with the commercial parties that will be engaged with the state. These contracts could be for consultants, very specialized help on potentially tight timelines to assist the state in navigating this new field. They could also be for project developers could involve potentially complex negotiations with a lot of different terms that allocate some risk and reward and benefit that go beyond the lowest solicitation wins, right? And that's largely the basis for that request. Again, also, because not all developers' business models are the same, it's hard to make an apples-to-apples comparison of the standard responses that you might get from interested parties. Under the procurement code. And while we do request this exemption, we also want to remind you that there is that best interest finding, again, that is required to actually push the go button on a project after the commissioner has evaluated the specific proposal. So while there remains that public process. It's not a black box.
So question on that. So remind me, a best interest finding, does that have to be presented to the legislature?
Madam Chair, I would turn to Director Collis again for that.
For the record, Christy Collis, Director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. No, a best interest finding does not go before the legislature. We actually draft a preliminary decision that goes out for public notice, goes to agencies, and we take in those comments. We might have to amend that preliminary decision and then come out with a final. I know that we do send some of our decisions to senators and representatives, especially if it's affecting their district. So, of course, we take in those comments as well.
Thank you.
For the record, this is Rena Miller continuing. Section 2 directs the program revenue from the carbon offsets program into a new fund to pay for program costs. The fund is actually created a little bit later in Section 6. Section 3 exempts Section 3 kind of conforms to Section 4 by waiving the typical lease award process, the competitive bid requirement. Instead, Section 4 sets up a specific set of criteria for evaluating and process for managing leases to private parties for carbon management purposes. The applicant is going to have to describe in detail their proposed carbon management use. The director will need to, by statute, evaluate that on more than simply potential revenue to the state. So again, there's more that's going to play into the decision of who, if there are competing people, this lease goes toward. It's not necessarily just the highest bidder. There's flexibility built into our proposal to be able to consider other benefits, other features, other attributes that are deemed by the director in the best interest of the state. And again, we're balancing that with some sideboards. There is still the best interest finding required to actually issue that lease.
So Ms. Miller, this talks about a bidding process. How public is that information? Are these closed bids? How does this work?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, are we talking about the new one? or the traditional one that we won't use?
Talks about bidders.
Okay.
And appeals to the commission within 5 days.
Director Collis?
Christy Collis, through the chair, Madam Chair. So this actually, Section 3, exempts the 08 carbon from going through the process of an auction or a bid. I'll be honest with you, that's not something typically that we do when we solicit interest for other bids. We go out, say we have an application for a wind farm, and they wanted something over 10 years, for 25 years, let's say. We'll go out and we'll solicit interest from other individuals for a wind farm at this location just to see if there's any other interest per the statute. Typically, I'd say 90-something percent of the time, we receive no interest other than the applicant that's gone out. So we don't have auctions. That's just not something that's ever been required. But it is something in the statute that we could do if it was necessary. But this would just exempt us from having to go out and do that solicitation of interest from other individuals for a project similar in nature at that location.
So this isn't like an oil lease, for example.
No, you know, I think it was visioned that way maybe when the statute was originally written. But I would say typically we just don't have that kind of competition or interest on state land. Since it's state land, you know, you can basically go anywhere where it's classified appropriately to have a lease for an operation of some sort of commercial use. And we look at those individually, and it's just not very often that we have any kind of competition between individuals that want to utilize a space for the same activity.
Thank you. All right, I'll let you go on.
For the record, Rena Miller, continuing with the sectional analysis. Director Collis just talked about the exemption in Section 3. Section 4 replaces that process that we're wanting to be exempt from with a new process specific to the carbon management purposes of a state land lease. This section provides application requirements. An application has to include, for example, that detailed summary of that proposed carbon management purpose that the land will be used for. It gives some direction to the director in case there are multiple applications on how to evaluate those against each other, considering things like the experience the applicant has with carbon management, how long the lease term is for, how the proposed project interacts with existing land uses of that particular site. It also provides an appeal process in the case of multiple applications. It does cap those leases, like we talked about, at 55 years. And it also allows this is a long lease to accommodate a carbon offset project's needs. But if the land isn't being used for the carbon management purpose that the lease was sought for, then that lease can be terminated. So there's a little bit of a backstop there. It makes it clear that a lessee is not entitled to that preference right to purchase that leased land that we discussed previously. I think importantly, it also requires that the compensation for a lease is designed to maximize that return to the state. And again, it may not just be a strict dollar amount per acre in that context. It gives the department flexibility, or the division flexibility, in negotiating some lease compensation terms that potentially even play into the profits of a project that's done on that leased land. It does also, again, the Section 4 requires that best interest finding in order for the division to issue that lease. And we move on to Section 5, unless there are questions.
Yes, I have a question. So on page 2, where Section 4 begins, line 29, it talks about the commissioner may lease the state land. But then on page 3, line 9, it says, if the director receives two or more applications. So who actually who's doing this? It says director and commissioner.
I'm going to turn to Director Collis on this
one. Okay.
Christy Collis, for the record. Madam Chair, so a lot of times the commissioner delegates down to the director. So typically it just depends on our delegations. I would say the commissioner may be the ones to offer out the leases, and then the director is the one that's actually authorizing those leases that we get applications for. And I do want to note that a lot of what Section 4 does is similar to what we already do with our other long-term leases. We already have a cap at 55 years for all of our other leases as well. The compensation that we're calling out is compensation that we already have under a statute 3805073. So these aren't new ideas. These are ideas that we're already implementing and have. So we're just really kind of taking a lot of that and implementing it into this new statute for this type of lease. So I wouldn't say it's new. It's something we've done in the past already.
Thank you.
For the record, Rena Miller, moving on to Section 5. This is sort of belt and suspenders to go into the leasee preference that's already in statute and make it clear that the state land leases for carbon management purposes are exempt from that granting of preferential rights. Now, Section 6 is kind of, I think, the core of this bill. It establishes the carbon offset program within DNR to undertake projects on state land. It enables the commissioner to enter into contracts with third parties to carry out the purposes. We spoke about that exemption from the procurement code. That's for this authorization. And there's also, I think, a really important piece that is sort of an affirmation of private property, private landowner rights, making it clear that while the state has these rules and terms to do a carbon offset program on state land, nothing applies or needs to interfere with a private landowner that wants to undertake a carbon offset program on their land. So Section 6 also sets forth the criteria that the department needs to use to evaluate potential carbon offset projects on state land. These are listed in the proposed Section 3895.410, beginning on page 4 of your bill. The department, that evaluation criteria would include considering the project's baseline and predicted additionality, making sure that the registry protocols that have been selected, in fact, are consistent with state law. They need to make sure that the project is consistent with the statute. And also, they need to consider any reasonably foreseeable effects that a project has on the state or local economy. It doesn't really end there, though, because if we jump down on page 5 to about line 10 in provision D, there's also a best interest finding required. And that will entail certainly a lot more analysis than just those particular evaluation criteria that were specific to a carbon offset program. So I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but if we go back up to B, we say state land generally will be available for carbon offset projects unless it's already by statute or regulation unavailable. And I think, Senator Bishop, this plays into potentially state land that's tundra, right? State land will generally be available for these projects.
A question, Ms. Miller. Looking at that, it feels like it conflicts with C, which says it may not be used without approval of the legislature, and it refers to legislative withdrawn land. So it's not actually making all land available.
Senator Giesel, Madam Chair, I had to go over this one a couple times. So the legislatively withdrawn land is that otherwise provided in statute or regulation in B above it, right? So B says unless otherwise provided in statute or regulation, state land will be available. So one of the things that is already otherwise provided in statute or regulation is legislatively withdrawn land.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. So again, that legislatively withdrawn land can't be used without approval by the legislature. But I just want to be very clear, the bill does give that legislative approval to use the legislatively withdrawn land that is the three state forests.
Great.
Can I add one clarifier? This is Christy Collis for the record. There is some legislatively designated areas that may allow us to do carbon projects. So we have, like, I think of the Bison Range, some other areas that potentially we could do these projects. We'll have to look at all of our legislatively designated areas to see whether or not we can't actually do a project within them. Some obviously will be stated that we can't and we'd have to come to the legislature, but some we may be able to.
So it won't necessarily be confined to state forests then?
That would be accurate, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Kaufman had a question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Through the chair. I guess I'll go to Ms. Miller on this one, and feel free to punt. So with the question about tundra being a potential, but then as we did the definition of terms, we talked about additionality, which is basically what's the delta or the difference between what would have been otherwise. I'm trying to imagine on a piece of tundra out in a remote area, how would we ever show additionality on tundra if that's kind of a key metric for establishing the carbon offset value of a property?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, I think that's a great question, and it's not a certain thing. What the intent is, as the commissioner stated, is to make the broadest possible range of lands available for this so that we can account for the, frankly, like incredible ingenuity that people are showing when it comes to ways to mitigate carbon emissions in the environment. You know, first you're talking about forests and then suddenly, oh, potentially kelp. You know, someone may come up with a potential project proposal that in fact does find a way to use tundra in a project design. Ultimately though, there are backstops, right? They do have to meet the additionality, and that's a requirement by that registry. So if they can't get, the registry essentially works as a backstop to ensure project truly is real and viable and can get that additionality. Because if it doesn't, you don't get to register it. You don't get to generate those credits from it.
I'll take the bait. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee, for the record. You know, just one potential scenario just to throw out. Obviously, there are extensive coal deposits on the North Slope. Those coal deposits may be economic to develop. An individual or the state may have the right to develop those lands. So if we were to forego that particular type of extraction, which of course would disturb a number of surface acres of tundra, that may be one mechanism by which you could prove additionality as it relates to tundra, just to throw a for instance out there.
Thank you for that.
A lot of really intriguing possibilities when we get into this whole idea of carbon offset programs. This is Rena Miller for the record, continuing with the sectional. Again, Section 6 requires that best interest finding that we talked about in order for the for a state offset project to be undertaken by the state on state land. It does cap those project terms at 55 years. And there's a requirement that state land used for a project has to remain open to the public for access for hunting, fishing, and other generally allowed uses. I jumped the slide too quickly. So once we've set forth that evaluation criteria and the best interest finding, we move on to the proposed Section 3895.420, still within Section 6. This is where we say that after there is this best interest finding, the director can enter into agreements to actually register that carbon offset project. Of course, that's the key that unlocks the mechanism to generate the revenue from the sale of those credits. It requires that the department maintain records for the project term and for any additional time that the registry may require. It specifies a few things that those department records must include for each project. Section 6 then establishes that carbon offset revenue fund. This fund is established outside of the general fund and would collect the revenues from any projects that do occur. And the funds could be used by the commissioner to pay the administrative costs of the program and to pay the costs of and to pay generally to fund actions under the program. Section 6 also includes quite a few definitions.
Before you go to the definitions, Ms. Miller,
yes.
Co-Chair Bishop had a question.
Thank you. Could you clear up something for me? Are these terms and conditions, you know, going on 3895.420, are these public records?
Are these, excuse me?
Public records. I mean,
are these public records?
Meaning, you know, if I wanted to walk into the office and take a look at the terms and sheets, could I do that?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I believe Chris Orman with the Department of Law is online, and I would love his input to be crystal clear on this.
That would be great. Mr. Orman, did you hear the question from Senator Bishop?
I did, Senator Giesel. This is Christopher Orman, Department of Law, Natural Resources Section. Through the chair, answering that question, yes, under 3895.420, those records that are being maintained would be public records under the Public Records Act.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. So let's see, we were up to definitions, I believe, in Section 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record, Rena Miller. Again, Section 6 has a lengthy definition section. There's 13 terms that relate to the new carbon offset program within DNR. We move on to Section 7.
Are there any questions about the definition section? All right, seeing none. Thank you. Go on to Section 7. Thanks.
Of course, Madam Chair. So Sections 7 through 9 enable DNR to do carbon offset projects within the Haines State Forest. And then Sections 10 through 13 enable carbon offset projects within other state forests. Haines is already broken out in statute this way, and so that's why we have essentially two sets of changes we have to go in and make to accomplish the same thing for all three forests.
So, Ms. Miller,
yes.
Why is the Haines State Forest called out separately? What's the reason?
Senator Giesel, this is a very good question for Chris Orman.
Okay. Mr. Orman.
Senator Giesel, this is Christopher Orman, Department of Law and Natural Resources Section. Regarding that question, so it comes down to the fact that the statutes are separate. So the Haines State Forest, and I think it's State Forest Recreation Area, which is under 4115-300, it's separate from the other state forests that end up then being called out and were withdrawn by the legislature. So that's why we end up having this distinction, this separation. So real quickly, I'm just looking at these so I give you the proper site so that you can so that I have this on the record. So the Haines State Forest Resource Management Area was withdrawn by the legislature, and that's identified under 4115-300 through 330. And so that's why there are these separate amendments, if you will, pertaining to that. Then we have the state forests that were created by the legislature in let me just make sure I get the citations right. 4117. Sorry. Right. So 4117-200 through 230. And so when the legislature then identified those state forests and the state forest system, it then created state forests under 4117-400 and as well as under 4117-500. So really the simple answer here is that when the legislature created both the Haines State Forest Recreational Area, and then created these state forests, it didn't do so together in the same, if you will, statutory areas. They actually were drafted in separate areas. So that's why you have kind of these amendments in two or three different areas to effectuate allowing for carbon offset projects in all of these various state forests. Does that answer your question? I know that was really long-winded.
It does answer it. Thank you. And kind of explains sections 9, 10, and 220, or 11 also. Yes, thank you. I'll let you proceed, Ms. Miller.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Rena Miller for the record. So again, section 7 through 9 relate to the Haines State Forest Resource Management Area. Section 7 says that carbon offset projects are legitimate use of the state land within that management area. Section 8 is sort of belt and suspenders, saying that the commissioner may manage that land for purposes consistent with the carbon offset program. And then Section 9, because a forest management plan is sort of the tool to carry out that management directive, goes into the Haines State Forest and Resource Management Area Management Plan, or management, multi-use management prescription, and says that a carbon offset project that's undertaken on that land has to be consistent with that management plan. The management plan has to identify appropriate land for a carbon offset project, and the department may amend that management plan to allow for such a project. And then we repeat this process in sections 10 through 13 for the Tanana Valley and Southeast State Forests. So section 10 essentially says that offset projects can be undertaken on these forest lands. Section 11 goes into the management directive and says that land within these state forests need to be managed under, along with the sustained yield principle, that chapter of law and the forest management plan, a carbon offset project undertaken by the department. Section 12 dips again into the management plans, allowing that a forest management plan can must consider and permit uses of that forest land for non-timber purposes, including carbon offset projects, providing that those are compatible with the primary purpose. And then Section 13, again, reiterates for those management plans for those other forests, a carbon offset project has to be consistent with that plan. The plan has to identify land appropriate for a project, and the department may amend that forest plan to allow for a carbon offset project. So, Madam Chair.
So, related to the forest management plans identified in sections 9, 12, and 13, sometimes the public wants to have a participation in management plan changes. Is that provided for also?
Senator, or Madam Chair, if we could call on Allison to talk about the public process involved with the forest management plans and amendments to it.
That'd be great. Ms. Allison, Arians, did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Allison Arians, Deputy Director of Division of Forestry. And yes, the management plans for all the state forests and state management areas, they all do require a public process, and that's laid out in statute. We do a draft plan for public review, and then we do the final review, and that all, we have to answer all the different comments that are made on that draft plan, and we do the final plan. Another public review period, and then it gets signed by the commissioner, and then there's also an appeal period that occurs along with that.
Great, thank you. All right, Ms. Miller.
All right. So continuing with the sectional analysis, Section 14 is the standard bill language authorizing DNR to adopt regulations implementing the bill. And Section 15 sets an immediate effective date for Section 14. And we'd certainly like to work with the committee to perhaps amend that to be an immediate effective date for the bill.
Gotcha. So how long do you anticipate, or have you already started the regulation process?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that a regulation process has been begun absent the authorization to do so. I've looked at Director Collis to confirm that.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. We have not started a process yet.
So usually regulations take about a year.
This is Christy Collis for the record. Yes, and that's if we're lucky, they take a year. I would say more like a couple, depending on the public interest, how many times we might need to go back out, just depending on the public comments that we receive. I would think with this particular legislation, we'd want to make sure that we're doing a good job with crafting our regulations. So I would say we would assume it will take a little bit longer with the 2 years, just to make sure that we do a good job.
Gotcha. Good. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have some high-level questions that I just like. While we've got such a great team here, I think it's a good time. So one of the criticisms of this plan is that Alaska already has so much land tied up in various, you know, federal land, state land, that there's very little free land, and that essentially this is going the wrong direction. And and that this is just doubling down into tying a property, and that we already don't have enough of it. I know that's kind of a big high-level question to hit you with, but could we just chat about that a little bit, about what mitigations there might be, or is that the wrong way to look at it?
Yeah, Senator Cochman, through the chair, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the record. I think that's a good question, and not to become too lawyerly, but I guess it also depends on what the word, you know, tie up and to define, you know, some of those mechanisms. Just speaking generally and from a high level, our position is that a carbon management project does not constitute the creation of, let's just say, like a new conservation unit. That is an area where, you know, other multiple uses are prescribed or limited. So, you know, carbon, an area of land within a carbon offset program, for instance, would be open for hunting, for fishing, for camping and recreating, for cutting firewood, for instance. As a number of your experts testified, these lands, you know, utilized as carbon offset projects can still be, you know, are still available for the building of infrastructure through them, can be available for surface disturbance if a valuable mineral deposit is discovered. You know, there's a tremendous amount of flexibility built into a number of these types of projects, and of course it's dependent on kind of a project by project basis and what the particular terms are. But really, you know, in the world that we see, there's a tremendous amount of flexibility there. In addition, you know, the state really has that obligation to take that well-balanced viewpoint. Constitution and the mandate under Article 8 to make sure that our resources are being maximized and conserved and developed for the best, you know, maximum use for the people. And, you know, I think that also gives us a perspective to make sure that as we go about implementing this program, it's done in a way that's mindful of the needs of maximizing resources for the people, that is in line with, you know, the state having desire to enable its people to have access to lands with respect to, you know, offering tracts of state land in the private ownership. You know, the state's obviously going to continue to pursue those efforts, pursue, you know, municipal land entitlements, things of that nature. So, you know, really there's a lot of toolkit kind of built in to ensure that, you know, these types of projects are really going to be developed in a well-balanced way that isn't locking up Alaska, that's not constraining or confining Alaskans to, you know, ever smaller areas of public lands. Really, these projects actually complement in a lot of ways a lot of the other kind of economic activities that we might hope to see to occur on some of these lands. As Rena mentioned earlier, you know, it could provide more opportunities for the building of forestry roads, which in turn would provide Alaskans, you know, cheaper alternatives to new hunting spots or new fishing grounds and things of that nature. So, you know, I really see this as maximizing opportunities and not really foreclosing opportunities when it comes to access and general land availability for Alaskans.
Thank you. May I ask another?
Follow-up, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. One of the other concerns is that this is essentially a new form of tax, and so this is basically creating carbon bucks, and then those bucks are traded, and whenever a currency moves around, typically a little of it gets shaved off here or there. There's always the broker's cut, and so that this is a form of tax that will come back to bite Alaskans. You know, at perhaps in fuel costs, because the producers that are paying a tax, generally they try to pass it on. It may either be passed on to consumers or to shareholders, depending upon the ability to if you can if you can share that cost with your customers and they'll pay it, then otherwise it's the shareholders that are taking the hit. So are we enabling a new tax by our actions if we were to do this?
Yeah, Senator Compton, through the chair, that's a concern that I've heard expressed in a number of different fora. What I would say is that no, this isn't the imposition of a new tax upon Alaskans. You know, the authority that we're looking for here is to give the state the ability to engage and evaluate with individuals in the private market, in the voluntary market in particular, that are interested in pursuing carbon offset projects in the state. You know, the state is not imposing a carbon tax. The state is not imposing a cap or trade system on existing entities within the state. The state is just recognizing that there are multiple mechanisms that are external to the state. That is, there could be some compliance markets where in some jurisdictions, whether they be states in the lower 48 or foreign countries, that may choose to impose taxes or fees or other costs on industry, which, you know, may or may not trickle down to, you know, the consumers in those states, other states or other countries that may provide funding mechanisms for some of these carbon offset credits. But, you know, those are things and issues that are outside of the control of the state. We just recognize that, you know, those forces exist, and there are other companies that are, you know, publicly traded that through the desires of their shareholders, of their board members to achieve certain environmental benchmarks or to achieve, you know, net zero types of efficiencies in their operations are voluntarily choosing to pursue carbon offset projects as a mechanism by which they can meet those environmental benchmarks. And so, you know, again, the state's not telling companies that they have to do this. The state is just saying, look, if this is an opportunity that you're interested in, we're happy to have a chat about it. And I think at least, you know, some of you may be aware there are existing companies in Alaska, and I'll just, you know, point out Santos is one example of an oil company that's here in the state that has publicly announced that their intent is to develop a new oil field, which we call the Pica Project, on the North Slope in a manner which is net zero in both Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. So that company on its own has decided that that is an objective that it wishes to achieve. And so by the state, you know, enabling this sort of regulatory framework to be implemented, we can be participants with them and recipients of some monetary benefit based on the decision making of their shareholders and their board. So, you know, I would say that this is not the state imposing taxes or costs on Alaskans. These companies are going to do it anyways. The choice for Alaska is, do we participate in this and profit off of it so that we can use those monies to provide more government services? In the case of carbon that's sequestered underground, bolstering our permanent fund, which ultimately would get redistributed out amongst the populace. You know, this is actually really a way for the state to help maybe mitigate some of those increased costs or impediments that some consumers may face by the voluntary choices of some of these companies or operators to embark in this type of venture.
Follow-up, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Earlier, I forget which section it was, but it was stated basically that the funds would go into designated funds in order to fund the program. One concern would be that the program just eats up all the profits. So proceeds are coming in. It's kind of running fat and happy. And so is there anything I don't believe there is presently, or that we could do to assure that if it's generating revenue, that it's actually spinning it off and not just becoming its own, you know, funding its own existence.
Yeah, Senator Coppins, through the chair, I think that's a good question. Clearly, it's the intent of DNR here to increase revenues to the state. You know, we're not looking at this as a mechanism to just grow our department or you know, increase the number of folks that are involved in the regulation or management of this activity. You know, our intent clearly is to bring in revenue to the state that exceeds the cost of our administering this program. And as Rena had mentioned earlier, you know, the state can actually play can play a role in this with very little risk exposure. That is, we in essence just offer land for lease. A project developer comes in, they pay us the lease fee, and then, you know, they kind of deal with everything else. So in that kind of scenario, you know, the incremental cost to the state and actually, you know, carrying out a program of that nature is very minimal. And so, you know, by definition, the state is going to be deriving more revenue from that activity than it's actually going to cost us to administer. And then, as Rena pointed out, there's actually opportunities if the state wants to go in and develop its own project, which would be more intensive. But, you know, again, the state wouldn't, the state doesn't intend just to jump, you know, headfirst into that realm. You know, we would fully intend to vet that, to, you know, utilize consultants and experts to help us evaluate whether or not that sort of opportunity made economic sense. And I think the state would only proceed in engaging in that type of project development if, you know, we had a high level of confidence that the, you know, potential revenues and reward return for the state, you know, outpaced whatever incremental costs the state would have to incur to actually develop and manage a project like that, you know, on its own volition.
Thank you.
You know, Commissioner, this project has a lot of appeal for folks that are looking to see the forest managed more productively. We have a lot of dead spruce on the Kinnick Peninsula. We've talked about that in this committee before. And so that makes it appealing. At the same time, I worry about the estimates of revenue. You know, as I look at the ANEW report, they identify Haynes Forest as the most productive area. They estimate it looks like anywhere from $15 to $25 per credit, you know, millions of dollars. And yet, hearing that the credits have dropped to $2, it's kind of concerning, especially as I think of the Delta grain storage and the seafood processing plant in Midtown Anchorage, a lot of boondoggles, right? So effort will be put into this. We'll be spending state money to put this into action. Regulations are not free. So that's, you know, it's just a concern. And the ANEW report is pretty recent. I mean, it was last August that it was completed. So one of the things I know I'll be asking we will be hearing the bill again. Obviously, we've just had the sectional. We'll have public testimony. I know you and your team will be here. That'll be great. But any update on the value of those credits would be helpful information for us to have. Any other questions for the commissioner designee and his team?
Actually, if I could respond, oh, yes. Senator Kiesel, I think those are really reasonable points to make. And I think, you know, we're also looking at this program through those lens because I think we're in concurrence. The state has a poor track record sometimes of picking winners and losers. And really that's why we're looking at this, that we're presenting this bill with this type of framework in mind that's really broad, that really gives us that flexibility to monitor and track how this nascent market develops so that we can really position ourselves and make a very educated and and well thought out decision on where it makes sense for the state to get involved in this space. And what I would say that at least should provide some level of confidence to the public, you know, worried about the disposition of public funds, you know, we're not talking here about the state going out and building a lot of infrastructure in the hopes that we're going to capitalize on a carbon program or a grain silo or something like that. You know, in this case, we're talking about a very modest increase in budget that would support some staffing, some increased staffing within the department. And of course, you know, these staff are not going to be folks that can only handle the processing of, you know, permits or, you know, disposing of state lands for carbon purposes. These are people that would have a lot of use to help, you know, make our permitting teams more robust, so perhaps we can be a little more efficient in processing other permits for mines, for oil and gas, you know, for other areas in which, you know, DNR is kind of regularly approached by the public. So really for this, you know, the investment of the state is really just, you know, bolstering the talent that we have within the state to enable private development to occur, so that by the form of us processing permits timely. And then we can wait and see how, you know, what the market, how the market evolves. Because, as you know, if we were to look at the stock market's performance today, we may say, well, that doesn't look like a great place to put our money. But, you know, tomorrow may be very different. And we recognize with the carbon market, you know, prices, just like stocks, just like commodities, are going to fluctuate. But, you know, I think as you engage with people, financiers, people that are really looking at the macro level on what's going on in the world, on what other regulations are being promulgated in other jurisdictions, the way that the markets are evolving, the movement of environmental social governance amongst publicly traded companies, and the targets being sent, the benchmarks being made, climate accords being reached, consensus is there's going to be a tremendous amount of demand for carbon credits. And beyond that, I think there's a number of people that just would like to see opportunities to enhance a forest's ability to absorb more carbon. And whether that's through, you know, planting more trees, by, you know, managing insect infestations, by mitigating wildfire risk, You get net benefits across the board. You get less emissions of carbon in the atmosphere. You get healthier forests. You may get a more robust wood products industry. And Alaskans get greener, healthier forests to look at as they drive, you know, down the Seward Highway to go fishing in Kenai or something like that. So there's a lot of benefits, I think, that accrue to the state with a very, you know, modest outlay of funds to really get us.
Very good. I appreciate those strong talking points in favor of the program. So at this time, we're going to set the bill aside. We will be, of course, bringing it forward again, public testimony, all that regular process. And we will have you back again starting March 6th. We're going to take up the sequestration bill. So thank you very much, all of you, as well as the folks online, for being here with us today and answering those questions. So that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be February 27th at 3:30 p.m. We're going to continue the presentation from February 13th by DEC on their 404 primacy feasibility study. So at this time, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:54 p.m.